sanctions kick in against Russia as a senator claims Russian operatives have penetrated local election offices. The razor-thin lead of a Trump-endorsed candidate for Kansas governor cut in half after a mistake in the count is discovered. The New York City Council votes to limit ride-sharing apps and the story behind an assassination attempt in Venezuela. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, August 8th, 2018. In the news, echoes of President Trump's election slogan, "Lock her up," were heard in Zimbabwe as opposition leader and finance minister Tendai Biti was taken into custody. Police in Zimbabwe had been looking for Biti and eight other opposition figures for allegedly fomenting violence following a disputed national election in which President Emmerson Mnangagwa was declared the winner. Six people were killed last week in an army crackdown on post-election protests against the victory of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Meanwhile, Russia condemned a new round of U.S. sanctions as illegal on Thursday and said it had begun working on retaliatory measures after news of the curbs pushed the ruble to two-year lows over fears Moscow was locked in a spiral of never-ending sanctions. Having bet heavily on improving ties with Washington via Trump, Moscow now finds that Trump is under mounting pressure from U.S. lawmakers to show he is tough on Russia ahead of midterm elections. Back in the United States, confusion broke out over claims by Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida of what he called Russian operatives who have penetrated some of Florida's election systems in advance of November's general election. This while United States intelligence agencies say they found no evidence vote tallies were changed. According to Nelson, "We were requested by the chairman and vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee to let the supervisors of election in Florida know that the Russians are in their records." The Tampa Bay Tribune says Senator Marco Rubio has raised similar warnings as Nelson, privately discussing them with county election officials. Rubio declined comment on Wednesday. The story remains fluid as a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security on Thursday denied Nelson's claim of Russian penetration, responding, "We have not seen any new compromises by Russian actors of election infrastructure." Senator Richard Burr, the Republican chairman of the Intelligence Committee, declined comment. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat, issued a statement that neither confirmed nor disputed what Nelson said. Florida Department of State says it received zero information supporting the claim. The Tribune says they are seeking more information on the disputed story. Meanwhile, President Trump tweeted this morning that there has been no evidence whatsoever that Donald Trump or the campaign was involved in any kind of collusion to fix the 2016 election. In fact, the evidence is the opposite, that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats colluded with the Russians to fix the 2016 election. In fact, there has been no credible evidence of the Democratic Party working with Russian agents. In more election news, Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, who got President Trump's endorsement, holds a 91-vote lead in a primary battle to become the GOP candidate for governor in November. Over 300,000 votes were cast. An immigration hardliner, Kobach was vice chairman of President Trump's short-lived voter fraud commission. The commission tried to show that Trump lost the popular vote in 2016 because of massive illegal voting on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Kobach has a long history of nativism and was an advisor to anti-immigrant Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was pardoned by Trump after a conviction for contempt of court. Numerous studies show little or no voter fraud in U.S. elections. Trump had declared victory on behalf of Kobach on Tuesday night until a mistake in the vote was corrected, cutting his lead in half. In New York City, as the trial of former Trump campaign officer Paul Manafort continues in a Manhattan federal courthouse, a New York Times report says lawyers for President Trump have rejected special counsel Robert Mueller's terms for an interview in the Russian investigation. Rudy Giuliani, Trump's lead attorney, says it's time for the Office of Special Counsel to conclude its inquiry without further delay. But if Trump declines to be interviewed, Mueller could take the extraordinary step of subpoenaing the sitting president before a grand jury, sparking a prolonged legal battle. Bill Clinton is the only president to have been subpoenaed while in office. He eventually agreed to a voluntary interview. Another electoral outcome apparently shows surging power among progressives, coming 4 years after the deadly police shooting that triggered racial unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. A black Ferguson city councilman scored an election upset and ousted the white prosecutor, criticized over his handling of the case. Weasley Bell defeated seven-term St. Louis County prosecutor Bob McCulloch in Tuesday's Democratic contest. The stunning victory assures Bell a win in November. The Republicans have not put up a candidate for the general election. People did not think it could be done, the 43-year-old Bell said Wednesday. On August 9, 2014, Michael Brown, an unarmed black 18-year-old, was shot to death by white Ferguson officer Darren Wilson after a street encounter escalated into a fight. Wilson said he fired in self-defense, while some witnesses claim Brown had his hands up. The killing led to months of often violent protests. A St. Louis County grand jury declined to indict Wilson. Rashad Robinson, a spokesperson for the Color of Change PAC, was one of the civil rights groups that backed Bell, called the victory a powerful rejection of Bob McCulloch and his decision not to pursue justice in the communities he was elected to serve. Bell has said he will not file charges in low-level nonviolent marijuana cases and will dismiss pending charges, and he said he will never seek the death penalty. Today also marks 40 years since a massive police attack and siege in Philadelphia against the Radical Move group. Founded by John Africa, its members took the same name, the same last name, Africa. On August 8, 1978, police tried to evict Move from their communal home with water cannons and battering rams. A police officer, James Ramp, was killed. Nine Move members were convicted and got sentenced up to 100 years in prison. Two died in jail. The first to be paroled, Debbie Africa, was released this week. Six remain in prison. In 1985, a second assault on a Move house in Philadelphia led to the dropping by police on the barricaded home of a bag containing military explosives. The resulting fire destroyed 65 homes and killed 11 people, including five children. In New York City, the city council, voted to regulate the growth of app-based ride services like Uber and Lyft. Yellow cab drivers praised the move, but opponents said Uber and Lyft provide needed services to neighborhoods outside Manhattan that are poorly served by yellow cabs. Many people of color have claimed over the years that yellow cabs avoid their hails or refuse to take passengers to the outer boroughs. Valerie Doré has the story.
Six recent suicides by yellow cab drivers helped spur the city council into action. Ride-hailing apps have cut into the bottom line for yellow cab drivers who are struggling to make ends meet. Yu Ming Kenny Chow, a cab driver whose body was found in the East River, owed $700,000 to his taxi medallion loans. Taxi drivers' loss of customers to ride-hail apps has only made the struggles worse. Legislation under the For-Hire Vehicle Regulation Package was sponsored by Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Bronx City Council members, along with the Council's Committee on For-Hire Vehicles. Brooklyn Council Member Stephen Levin says the legislative package brings much-needed oversight and accountability to the ride-hail vehicle industry.
Even when we were last discussing this issue in 2015, the number of for-hire vehicles on our streets has almost doubled since that time. The market is, in fact, oversaturated, and as a result, drivers are struggling to make ends meet. So Intro 144 accomplishes several goals. First, it addresses the need to make pay more equitable for all drivers by pressing the pause button on the number of licensed for-hire vehicles, otherwise known as FHVs, on our streets. The one-year cap maintains our current level and prevents greater saturation of the market. I hear from drivers all across the industries who say that they're driving around for longer, having a harder time getting rides, and earning less income.
Levin's bill requires the Taxi and Limousine Commission to do a 12-month study on whether regulations are needed for the number of for-hire licenses and the licenses of ride-hail app drivers. It pauses new licenses for ride-hail drivers, except for those who have wheelchair-accessible cars.
One of my bills, 838B, it's a bill to regulate Uber.
Bronx Councilmember Ruben Diaz is chair of the City Council's Committee on For-Hire Vehicles.
We have to make a difference between regulating Uber and capping Uber. Capping Uber is for 1 year, regulating Uber is done for have no time. So one of my bills, again, 838B, is to regulate Uber. And if that bill is approved by you, my colleagues, New York City will make history being the first city in the nation to regulate Uber.
Diaz's bill creates a new category for ride-hail services, which dispatch over 10,000 rides a day. The penalty for operating without the license is a $10,000 fine. Another bill in the package from Brooklyn Councilmember Brad Lander gives the TLC the authority to set minimum fares for trips. And while taxi drivers are hailing the legislation as a victory, some riders aren't so sure.
I have to take Uber from East Flatbush, and it's hard to wait for one. You have to wait like 15 minutes, and if they make Uber less available, I would have to wait probably even longer.
It would stop me from getting home on a night out. That's kind of what I normally use it for. If I'm late, it's late, and I don't want to go home like by transport, public transport, or if I'm, you know, running super late to go somewhere, then I think it would probably, impact me like that. I probably wouldn't go out as much, and I'd be late.
Anything that's passed that's going to cause me as a customer to pay more money, I have a problem with that.
The yellow now is very down because of the Uber. We can't get any customer now.
This yellow cab driver, who has been on the job for 6 years, thinks Uber drivers cause too much traffic in the city.
The business is very down. We have problem to get the customer. The second two, we have too much traffic. You cannot drive fast because Uber, these people, they don't drive fast. Anytime he look, is the call. That's why. He make too much traffic.
The package of bills now go to Mayor Bill de Blasio, who is expected to sign the legislation. Valerie Duray, WBAI News, New York.
And a rally was held in support of the city's action. The mayor attended, I'm told, and that was held in Union Square Park. In environmental news, a federal court Thursday ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to ban a widely used pesticide that's been linked to learning disabilities in children. The ruling was a sharp rebuff to former administrator Scott Pruitt, who refused to take the chemical off the market. Under Obama, the EPA proposed permanently banning the chemical on food crops, citing potential risks to human health. Department of Agriculture studies show residues of the pesticide in nectarines, peaches, cucumbers, and other crops. Earth Justice, one of the three groups suing the EPA to force a ban on the chemical, which is called chlorpyrifos, said that the agency had exposed children and farm workers to this poison for decades. In May, Hawaii became the first state to ban the pesticide. In New York State news, Governor Andrew Cuomo welcomed a suit by the National Rifle Association asserting New York's anti-gun actions have cost the group millions of dollars. The NRA says it's facing financial ruin after New York's Department of Financial Services blocked an NRA insurance program for gun owners. The state warned banks and insurers they face reputational risk by doing business with the organization. That followed the Parkland, Florida mass school shooting. On Thursday, Cuomo blasted the NRA for pleading poverty in the lawsuit while funding a $1 million ad campaign to get President Trump's U.S. Supreme Court pick Brett Kavanaugh confirmed.
Their papers said we jeopardized their financial health. Well, apparently it's not that jeopardized, or they've had a very quick rebound in their health, because they announced yesterday that they're going to do a $1 million campaign to get Judge Kavanaugh approved and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And they're going to spend $1 million of their own money to do that. If they have $1 million to do a campaign for Judge Kavanaugh, obviously their financial health isn't that bad, right? Which is the exact opposite of what they said in the court papers just a few days before. So I would never doubt their credibility. Therefore, they must have had a very quick rebound in their financial health in the span of 48 hours. I think it shows their duplicity and, once again, how they are loose with facts and loose with the truth. And it says that they were fraudulent in their papers. And it also shows that from the NRA's point of view, They own the President of the United States, who did a White House conference the day after Parkland, where he actually sounded like a reasonable human being on the issue of guns, met with the NRA and did a 180-degree reversal, and the next day was against everything. So they control the president, they control the Congress, and now they want to control the Supreme Court. It would be a trifecta for the NRA. They control every branch of the federal government. They have stymied gun reform in this country almost single-handedly because they are bullies and they are extortionists and they frighten the Republicans in Congress by suggesting that they're not conservative enough, which would then open up all the Republicans to primaries, and they actually stop compromise common sense gun reform. 90% of the American people say they want background checks. How can they not be passed? Because the NRA won't allow any compromise.
Meanwhile, Cuomo's Democratic primary challenger, actress Cynthia Nixon, criticized the governor for claiming pride in his F political rating by the NRA. Nixon pointed out that Cuomo's running mate, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, once received an A rating from the gun organization and ran as a gun rights supporter for Congress in 2012. The state of New York has filed papers to throw out the NRA lawsuit. In more international news, Venezuela's government arrested and charged six people in the August 4th drone attack on President Nicolas Maduro during the 81st anniversary celebrations of the Bolivarian National Guard, the GNB, in Venezuela's capital. Sally O'Brien has more.
In addition, on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza told reporters he'd reached out to the U.S. Embassy in Caracas seeking the extradition of Osman Delgado Teboski, currently living in Miami, Florida. Delgado is accused of financing what many are seeing as an attempt to assassinate the Venezuelan president. The day before, Venezuela made public testimonies, quote, of the material authors of the assassination attempt, showing evidence that opposition leader Julio Borges, based in Colombia, also participated in the attack. For its part, the U.S. State Department has declined to comment on what was discussed with Venezuela or whether Venezuela had actually made any extradition request. Meanwhile, messages and statements of support and solidarity from world leaders, governments, and intellectuals continue pouring in, condemning Saturday's assassination attempt against the president. Ecuador and Uruguay are the latest countries to issue strong statements condemning the attack against President Maduro and expressing solidarity with the victims and their families. And on Sunday, the Turkish Foreign Ministry issued a statement condemning the attack, followed by statements of support by the Russian and Spanish governments. Statements were also sent by Dominica, Nicaragua, and South Africa. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, was among the first to publicly denounce the attack, and Cuba, a strong ally of the Venezuelan government, condemned the attack on President Maduro, calling it, quote, an act of terrorism which ignores the will of the Venezuelan people. From Quito, Ecuador, journalist Greg Wilpert of the Real News Network has more on this story.
Saturday evening, an assassination attempt against the life of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and other high government officials was prevented in the last minute. The attack took place during a celebration of the country's military while Maduro was giving his closing speech. Two explosions took place during the live broadcast, which then abruptly ended when a military personnel scattered from the blast area. Seven people were said to have been injured. Here's the footage of what was broadcast at the time. Later, other videos surfaced from people in the crowd, which showed that two drones were involved in the attack. One drone ended up being shot in mid-air and exploding. The other drone crashed into a nearby building and caused a fire there. President Maduro quickly blamed the government of Colombia, whose president, Juan Manuel Santos, immediately denied involvement. John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor, also denied involvement, even though Maduro did not accuse the U.S. for a change. Here's what Bolton told Fox News.
Well, I can say unequivocally there was no U.S. government involvement in this at all. It could be a lot of things from a pretext set up by the Maduro regime itself to something else.
Joining me now from Mérida, Venezuela, to discuss the assassination attempt is Paul Dobson. Paul is a writer with the website VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Also, he is currently involved in the Venezuela Committee of International Solidarity and a number of grassroots collectives ranging from communicational projects to ecological issues, as well as in his Camino Council in Venezuela. Thanks for joining us today, Paul. What do we know? What has been confirmed so far as to exactly what happened on Saturday evening?
Yes, well, so far, as you explained in the introduction, we have a combination of official announcements from the government, from the interior minister and other members of the cabinet, as well as a series of amateur footage of people who were enjoying the spectacle of the military parade, which marked the 81st anniversary of the National Guard. When we combine all of these elements, a fairly clear picture has emerged. This picture is of a series of drones, industrial-sized drones, technically called the DJI M600 drones, which are used more commonly in for filming cinema and films. They're used to carrying large cameras and heavy weights. Two drones were downed very close to the presidential stage and exploded. One hit a building and caused a fire, as you pointed out, which was mistaken for a gas leak. And the other one exploded in midair, as the footage shows. About an hour and a half after this attack, a Twitter account used by a right-wing grouping claimed responsibility for this attack. No? This grouping, it's not a political party, it's an anonymous Twitter account called T-Shirt Soldiers, which was founded in March 2014, claimed that they had sent the drones with C4 explosive with the objective of killing the president. No? This was reinforced shortly afterwards by a statement which was read by Venezuelan journalist Patricia Poleo, who is currently working on a private TV station in Miami, who received a statement from the same grouping, T-Shirt Soldiers, and read it out without making any comment. The statement read out by Patricia Poleo, again, claimed responsibility for the activity and elaborated a few political objectives of this grouping, which had tried to assassinate the president. Amongst these objectives were, according to them, the restoration of the constitutional order, new elections, and the formation of a transitional government. They also call Venezuelan people onto the streets, it's a direct quote, for the taking of power. No? They also, when we look into their political background or their orientation, little is known of who exactly is behind this group of T-shirt soldiers. But when we look at their Twitter account and their other media, we can see that they're a very extreme right-wing grouping, very anti-government, and most likely were created, organized in the 2014 violent street protests which looked to overthrow the democratically elected government at the time.
So, Paul, the government says that it has arrested six individuals so far. Is there anything known about who they are or what their connections are?
At the moment, little has been released. The names of the citizens has been released by authorities. Suffice to say, they're not well-known personalities or politicians of any way, shape or form. They were arrested in the state of Barinas on the highway which basically leads from Caracas to Colombia, one of the major highways out of the country, last night and during the course of Sunday. There are still numerous citizens which the police authorities are searching for. They have published photographs and names of these citizens to help in their search for them. But as yet, little has been declared about either the financing for this campaign, for this attack, the intellectual authors, and so on.
Paul Dobson writes for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. He spoke with Greg Wilpert, reporting for the Real News Network in Quito, Ecuador. And for the WBAI Evening News, I'm Sally O'Brien.
In more right-wing Watch News, anti-fascist counter-protesters are preparing to counter Trump-supporting white supremacists at a Unite the White rally in Washington, D.C. this weekend. Starting Saturday in Lafayette Park near the White House, the rally marks 1 year since a similar gathering of neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, Virginia. A 32-year-old anti-fascist protester, Heather Heyer, was murdered by a white supremacist who ran her down with his car after the rally. And filmmaker Michael Moore unveiled a first look at his new critique of Donald Trump, Fahrenheit 11/9, today, Thursday. The film premieres next month at the Toronto International Film Festival before hitting theaters on September 21st.
How the f*** did this happen?
I'm sick and tired of people telling me that America is the greatest country because we can whip your ass.
I hate some of these people, but I'd never kill them.
How do you deal with this? You're never going to be able to unsee what you saw.
Try to impeach him. Just try it. You will have a spasm of violence in this country like you've never seen.
Governor Snyder, I got some Flint water for you.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, and you've got to make it stop.
If nobody's gonna do it, then I gotta do it.
And I don't give a who you are. I'll fight you in the damn street right now.
Okay.
How the f*** did this happen?
The American dream is dead. Stop resisting.
The president's powers here are beyond question.
Ladies and gentlemen, the last president of the United States.
Coming to an American city near you.
Moore's 2004 film Fahrenheit 9/11 about George W. Bush became the highest-grossing documentary in history, earning more than $220 million at the box office. And that's some of the news for Thursday, August 9th, 2018. The news was produced with Valerie Dure and Sally O'Brien. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.